Everybody, and I hope everyone had a rewarding Yom Tov. And people say that they've gone through a Yom Tov, but the question always is, as Rav Huttner used to say, did Yom Tov go through us? Were we changed? Were we transformed? And the like. And the Chazon Ish gave a wonderful mashal about inspiration. He said, if you put a pot on the fire, and the pot is bubbling over, you don't really know if the pot is full or mainly empty, because even a half-empty pot will give you the appearance of overflowing when it's connected to the heat source. The only way you know how much the pot really has is when it's off the fire and it still overflows, then you know it's full. So he says, same thing with Yom Tov. If you are inspired during a Yom Tov, that does not really prove that you've changed and you've grown, because you're on the fire. It's only when you're off the fire that we really see. And that's why, I'm not going to talk about this now, but just the kitzer, one might say that the month of Cheshvan is extraordinarily important. It is a month without Yomim Tovim. It is the epitome of the ordinary life. And the real litmus test of what Tishrei meant to us is, how does it get translated into Cheshvan? Cheshvan is the gift of the ordinary, and the gift of the ordinary determines whether we've really grown and we've been inspired. So be this admitted, what I want to talk about today, and I may not be able to finish it in one session, but I think I'll get the main points, at least, of this prat, is that in addition to being a new year, this, of course, is a Shemitah year. And Shemitah is a holy year. It's the Panovich Rav used to go around on Shemitah and kiss the trees and wish the trees a good Shabbos, because the Torah describes Shemitah as Shabbat Haaretz. It is the Shabbos of the land. The land is supposed to get a rest, and this only applies to the land of Israel. So perennially, every single Shemitah going back for almost 100 years now, actually more than 100 years now, we have certain halachic controversies that occur, and I just want to go over some of the background. Again, my point here is not so much to paskin halacha. Obviously, there are going to be many, many shilas, but to give you some conceptual background to understand what are the issues. In the laws of Shemitah, there are essentially two separate categories of laws. There are what you might call agricultural restrictions. You're not allowed to plant, you're not allowed to cultivate, etc. And then there are laws that even things that grow wild, like fruits on the apple tree that you pick, if they are Shemitah fruits, have to be treated in a certain level of holiness. So, for example, if you have a Shemitah apple, you can't just throw away the parts that you don't like, but you have to be very, very careful. You have to have a special, I won't call it a garbage container, because technically it's not, but a special container in which you only put Shemitah fruit. Right? This is called Kedusha Shavias. So there are two separate halachas. One is a set of halachas pertaining to the farmer. Now, for many of us, that's not going to apply. On the other hand, if you have a garden, or if you have flower pots, you know, you need to be concerned. Those are what you might call production halachas. What can I do in my garden? What do I do in my field? What do I do with my fruit trees? And then you have the issues of Shemitah vis-a-vis the consumer, meaning how do I run Shemitah produce in the kitchen and the like. And there are many, many, many halachas, and I'm not here tonight to go over those halachas. Maybe we'll have other sessions on it. But I do want to discuss one particular issue, which is really the primary machlokas today between the Rabbanut and many of the other Hashkachot, and that is the concept of what is called the Heter Mechira. And this is a fascinating, fascinating question that goes back, well, actually, it goes back around 500 or 600 years, but it has had a resurgence in the last century. And that is, the Rabbanut's position officially is that if all of the arable, all of the cultivatable land in the state of Israel is sold to non-Jews, it is not subject to the Shemitah laws, and the land can be cultivated, and the fruits and the vegetables and the grains don't have any Shemitah Kedusha to it, and you can eat them the way you'd eat them in a regular year. On the other hand, the Mahadrin Hashkachot, generally, the yeshiva world, generally rejects the concept of Heter Mechira. And I want to go over, number one, why that is so, or what is the basis of the disagreement. And number two, I want to raise a very important question that comes up a lot, and that is, if I am machmir not to rely on heter mechira. Can I eat at somebody's house who follows heter mechira? Like, what do I do when I'm confronted with that situation? That's a very practical problem, and it happens quite a lot. Okay. So first, let's go back to the 1500s, the middle of the 16th century in Sfat. If we could go backwards in time, we would find, and this is shortly after the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion of the Jews in Spain, and as a result, there is a center, a great center of Torah in the land of Israel, many of whose leaders came from the Spanish Inquisition. But the great Torah center of Israel at the time is not Yerushalayim, although there were Gedolei Yerushalayim. The great Torah center of the land of Israel at the time is up north in the city of Tzfat. There in Tzfat, we have the great Mekubalim, the great mystics, Rav Moshe Cordovero, and later the Arizal, who's only there for 2 years. The Arizal died, hard to believe, at the age of 39. He came to Eretz Israel at the age of 37. So the Arizal's whole career as a teacher of Kabbalah was only 2 years, and he died at that young age. But the Rav of Tzfat is none other than the great Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yosef Karo was a four-year-old child at the time of the expulsion of the Jews of Spain in 1492. He actually was in his mother's arms. Imagine, at the head of the procession was Rav Yitzchak Abarbanel, who was the finance minister of Spain, and he was the head of the Jewish community. Towards the end of the procession was the little boy who would later become Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Be it as it may, just to give you a sense of the difference, Rav Yosef Karo was in his 70s when the Arizal came to Eretz Yisrael as a 37-year-old person. And although Rav Yosef Karo himself was both the Gadol Hador in Halacha, and he was also a great Mekubal in his own right, he would go to the Arizal's Shiurim on Shabbos to hear the Arizal's teachings in Kabbalah. But it is recorded, and I say this only because it is recorded, that he usually fell asleep during the Arizal's Shiurim. And the Arizal said, "It was decreed in Shemayim that I should not be your Rebbe. You are so great that it was decreed that it would not be covered for you to learn things from me. And therefore Hashem put you to sleep all the time." But if you just go through the Gedolim, and I know this is a little off the topic, but it is a fascinating thing. The Gedolim, the critical mass of great people that were in Tzfat in the middle of the 16th century. You have Rav Yosef Karo. You have the Arizal. You had Rav Moshe Cordovero, who was Nifter a little before the Arizal came. I'm sorry, shortly after the Arizal came. You have Rav Shlomo Alkabit, the author of L'Hadodi, who is a great Mekubal. You have Rav Moshe Alshich, who is the Darshan of Tzfat, who is the author of many great Perushim on Tanakh. You have Rav Yisrael Najara. We know him as the composer of Karbi Bam. But again, they didn't just write one Zemer. I mean, these are great Mekubalim. But one of the greatest people in Tzfat was a Rav that is known as the Mabit. Mabit is an abbreviation. Moshe ben Yosef Trani. Trani is from Italy, because originally the origin of their family was from Italy. The Mabit. The Mabit's father was also a very famous Gadol, the Maharit. That's Rav Yosef Trani. So Mabit is Moshe ben Yosef Trani. Maharit is Rav Yosef Trani. It's a little confusing because there are two Maharits. There is the father of the Mabit and there's the son of the Mabit. So there's a Maharit senior, Maharit junior, with Mabit in the middle. But be it as it may, why am I telling you all of this? Well, number one, I like to digress. But number two, the yesod of all of the controversies about heter mechira revolve around a fundamental machlokes between Rav Yosef Karo and the Mabit. And the reason this machlokas emerged in the 1500s is that is when, for after hundreds of years, there was a sizable aliyah of Jews to Eretz Israel, and Jews began to get involved in agriculture, particularly up north in the Galil. And as a result, the laws of Shemitah were no longer theoretical laws that we studied in the diaspora. They became practical laws once again because of the concentration of Jews in the Galil. So as a result, we find in the time of the Beis Yosef a number of important, very important discussions about how to practically keep Shemitah. And Rav Yosef Karo was Mechadesh, based on reading of the Rambam and earlier sources, the following idea. Rav Yosef Kairo was Mechadesh, that land of Eretz Yisrael that belongs to non-Jews is not subject to the laws of Shemitah. This is Rav Yosef Kairo. This is called Yevul Nachri. Right, the produce grown on property that is owned by non-Jews is not subject to the laws of Shemitah. Therefore, such land can be agriculturally cultivated, even by Jews, because a Jew is just working for a goy. In other words, the land has the status of chutz la'aretz land, and the fruit does not, or the fruit or the vegetables or the grain does not have the laws of the holiness of Shemitah. This is Rav Yosef Kairo. The Mabit took the position that every single inch of land in Eretz Yisrael has the holiness of the land of Israel. It makes no difference if it is owned by non-Jews or owned by Jews. Therefore, the Mabit took the position that the laws of Shemitah 100% apply to land that is owned by non-Jews. Now, granted, even the Mabit admits the non-Jew doesn't have a prohibition to work his land because Shemitah is not one of the seven commandments of Noah, but a Jew cannot work on the land owned by a non-Jew, and the produce that is produced is sanctified with the laws of Shemitah. So we start off with this fundamental machlokes between Rav Yosef Kairo and the Mabit, and I'm going to give you a little background as to the logic of the two sides, whether the laws of Shemitah apply to land that is owned by a non-Jew in the land of Israel. Rav Yosef Kairo essentially says, land owned by a non-Jew in Israel is equivalent to chutz la'aretz, as long as the non-Jew owns it. The Mabit says, no, land that is owned in the land of Israel is still Eretz Yisrael. The laws of Shemitah apply. The land cannot be cultivated, and the peiros, if they do grow, do have the Kedusha Shavias. Now, it's interesting that in terms of pure authority, Rav Yosef Kairo was the man in charge. He was the Rav of Tzvat. He was the Posek. And he issued a number. For some reason, Rav Yosef Kairo was very sensitive about this. Perhaps because he was sensitive to the fact that, as Rav Kook was hundreds of years later, that if you're machmer on the laws of Shemitah, even on land that is owned by the Arabs or owned by non-Jews, you would be making it very difficult for Jewish people to obtain of food. So he issued a number of proclamations prohibiting the Mabit from even disseminating his psak. And at one point he even threatened the Mabit with cheirim, an excommunication. Very unusual. In other words, we're used to thinking about these poskim as kind of ivory tower people who just talk about halacha. But no, this was a very personal issue. The Beis Yosef used very, very harsh terms against the Mabit. And I just have to share with you a very humorous, maybe it wasn't humorous at the time, but in retrospect it's a bit humorous, a statement the Mabit writes, that the Mabit was vilified, especially by the Talmidim of Rav Yosef Kairo, because he was going against Rav Yosef Kairo. And they told the Mabit, how dare you argue with Rav Yosef Kairo, who is HaMelech HaKadosh, he is the Holy King, referring to the fact that the Gemara calls Talmidei Chachamim kings, and they said, he is the Holy King. So the Mabit responded, even HaKadosh Baruch Hu was only called HaMelech HaKadosh during Aseret Yemei Tshuva, and not the rest of the year. So don't call your Rebbe HaMelech HaKadosh all the time. So this turned out to be quite a personal machlokas between the Mabit and Rav Yosef Kairo, and it's so fascinating that 600 years later it becomes a personal fight between Rav Kook and many other people. But here, in order to understand though the issue of Heter Mechira, we have to really go back to Mabit and Rav Yosef Kairo and understand what is the reasoning of each position. And if you understand that, you will understand the Heter Mechira controversy. Rav Yosef Kairo gives two different reasons why the laws of Shemitah should not apply to land that is owned by a non-Jew. Again, what do I mean by saying the laws of Shemitah don't apply? Therefore, a Jew is allowed to cultivate that land and work for the goy. And number two, the produce does not have the kedusha of Shemitah. And that is the following. The first question is the observance of Shemitah today a Torah commandment, or is it a rabbinic commandment? Now, in some sense, it doesn't make a difference, because we have to keep rabbinic commandments as well. But what would the issue be? Well, on one hand, Shemitah is in the Torah, Parshas Behar. On the other hand, most Rishonim say that the observance of Shemitah Bizman Hazeh is not a Torah requirement. It is only a rabbinic requirement. Why would it be Rabbanan? Because the Torah talks about Shemitah in connection with the Yovel year. Right? Every 7 years you have a Shemitah. Every 50th year you have a Yovel. Now, with respect to Yovel, which we don't keep today at all, with respect to Yovel, the Torah says the mitzvah of Yovel only applies when all of the Jews, or at least most of the Jews, are living in the land of Israel. So until you have most of the Jews in the land of Israel, there is no Yovel. And that is, in fact, agreed upon. In point of fact, therefore, not only was there no Yovel after the temple was destroyed, there was no Yovel even during the second temple period, because most of the Jews did not return to Eretz Israel. And indeed, after the exile of the 10 tribes, around 120 years before the destruction of the first temple, Yovel lapsed. So we haven't had Yovel from over 100 years before the Churban Bayis Rishon. Not Bayis Sheni.
Never came back.
Yovel has not been back since the exile of the 10 tribes. Now, there is somewhat of a discussion, interestingly enough. Will Yovel come back? Because demographically, we are, Baruch Hashem, approaching a situation where over 50% of those who are identified as Jews may be back in the land of Israel. Right now we have something like 48%. We're pretty close. And is that going to bring back Yovel? Now, Yovel, you think Shemitah is complicated. Yovel is enormously complicated, because when Yovel comes back, you know, land has to go back. So people who own hotels on the Tel Aviv beach strip, there's going to be some guy that's going to claim he's from the tribe of Yisachar or Zebulun, and, you know, gets that. And how is that going to be adjusted? But the truth of the matter is, I'll tell you the truth. The truth of the matter is, number one, the statement that you're going to have over 50% of the Jews living in the land of Israel, you know, that's hardly dispositive, because we have all sorts of unknown pockets of Jews all over the world. And number two, it seems from the Gemara that it's not just a numerical calculation. But when we say, when all the Jews come back, we have Yovel, that means we have the tribal division. Everybody is living in their tribal portion. That's not going to happen until Mashiach comes. So I think it's safe to assume that no matter how many Jews live in the land of Israel, there is no Yovel. Now, nobody argues with that. But here is what most Rishonim say. Most Rishonim say, since Shemitah is juxtaposed to Yovel in Parshas Behar, whenever there is no Yovel, there is no Shemitah. So, there's no Yovel because you don't have most of the Jewish people in the land of Israel in their tribal portions. And there is no Shemitah min HaTorah because Shemitah is compared to Yovel. However, the Rabbanan were misaken that there should be the observance of Shemitah, so we should remember the mitzvah. Tosos asked the question, well, if there's such a thing as rabbinic Shemitah, then why don't we have rabbinic Yovel? In other words, Yovel doesn't exist even on a rabbinic level. Shemitah exists on a rabbinic level. Well, the answer to that is, Tosfos says, that the rabbis didn't want to make a takana where you wouldn't be able to cultivate land for 2 years in a row. Because keep in mind that Shemitah is every 7th year. So the 49th year of a cycle is a Shemitah year. The 50th year is a Yovel year. If you bring back Yovel, then rabbinically you'll have 2 years in a row where you have Shemitah-like restrictions. So even though the Torah put us in that situation, but the Rabbanan are not. Okay. All right. Therefore, the bottom line of all this is, giving you background of Yosef Cairo, is that Shemitah is obligatory today, to be sure, but Shemitah is rabbinic. It is not a Torah requirement. Okay, and there are some Rishonim who argue, but the overwhelming majority of authorities do take the position that Shemitah is rabbinic today. Now, Rav Yosef Cairo argues, and again, some of the argument is too lengthy to go through here fully, is that we find that whenever a mitzvah is rabbinic rather than Torah, we find the ownership of the goy takes off the holiness of the land. Meaning, if there would be a mitzvah min haTorah, like taking off truma and maaser, let me give you an example. Taking off trumos and maaseros is a Torah commandment. Although that's a question too, but let's just assume that. So, if I buy produce from a non-Jew, I may have to take off trumos and maaseros, because the ownership of a non-Jew does not take off commandments of Eretz Yisrael that are Torah-based. But, Rabbi Yosef Kairo says, since the observance of Shemitah is midrabanan, it is rabbinic-based, so a proof from the Gemara in Gittin that the ownership of a non-Jew can be mafkia. Mafkia means to be mevatel, to annul any obligations of a rabbinic nature. So that's reason number one, which means, according to Rabbi Yosef Kairo, the heter that Yavul Nachri is not, or the land of a Nachri is not subject to Shemitah, only works because Shemitah is rabbinic, meaning when Shemitah would be a Torah law, then it wouldn't work. But Midrabanan, it works. Now, Rav Yosef Kairo then gives a second reason, that there might be a special drasha in the Torah that exempts non-Jewish land and produce from the laws of Shemitah, because the Torah says over and over again, Artzecha, you shall not farm, or sadcha, lo sizra. Do not plant your field, sadcha, so that implies your field and not property belonging to a non-Jew. Now, there is a big difference between these two lines of reasoning, because like the first line of reasoning, Yavul Nachri would work only if Shemitah's midrabanan, which it is today. According to the second reason, it's a drasha, then even if Shemitah is Doraisa, the Torah itself is telling you that the laws of Shemitah don't apply to the land of a goy and to the produce of a goy. Rav Yosef Kairo does not decide which reason is important, because he says, after all, since Shemitah is Rabbanan, so both reasons will apply. We don't need to decide which reason would be dominant. Mabit disagrees with both of these positions. Now, what is the base? Now again, let me emphasize, be sure you understand one thing. It's very important that you understand this to keep it in perspective. The Mabit and the Beis Yosef are not talking about selling land to the goy. They are not talking about that. They are talking about land that already belongs to goyim. Arabs already own the land. Does it have the laws of Shemitah? Okay? Don't assume that this is identical to the later tachnit of deliberately selling the land. That later idea is built on this machlokas, but this machlokas itself is not about selling land. Rav Yosef Kairo did not openly advocate any program of selling land to non-Jews. And in those days that wouldn't have been wise, because he certainly wouldn't get it back. It's not like today. Okay, so be sure you understand this. They are talking about land already owned by non-Jews. Okay. Now, what is the halacha on this principle of the Mabit and the Beis Yosef? Fundamental principle. So the truth of the matter is, fascinatingly enough, over hundreds and hundreds of years, different minhagim developed within Eretz Yisrael itself. The old minhag of Yerushalayim, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, is to follow Rav Yosef Kairo, that the produce that is grown on non-Jewish land is not subject to the laws of Shemitah, and that land is can be farmed and cultivated. And I want to emphasize, when I say it's the Minhag Yerushalayim, I don't mean only of Dati Leumi or Rav Kook or the Rabbanut. Even the Eid HaCharedis, the Badatz itself, that's why you have to understand that 90% of what the Heter Mechira is based on is absolutely accepted, even by the Eid HaCharedis. And that is, they will buy and sell Arab produce and say it is not subject to Shemitah laws. So you may be confused, so why do they disagree with the Heter Mechira? I'll get to that. Now, Bnei Brak. Now, Bnei Brak is not an old city. Bnei Brak is a city that only dates, I think, from the 1920s. But Bnei Brak, of course, the guiding light of Bnei Brak, was of course the Chazon Ish, who came to Bnei Brak in the 1930s, and all of Bnei Brak is miyusad on the psukim of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was machria like the Mabit. So according to the Chazon Ish, even non-Jewish land is subject to the laws of Shemitah, and the produce that is grown on non-Jewish land, even by Goyim, has the holiness of Shemitah. Right? So this is a famous machlokas, Yerushalayim and Bnei Brak. This is an instance where the Minhag Yerushalayim, and I include, again, even the Eidah Haredis, even the most religious elements of Yerushalayim, the Minhag of Yerushalayim is that Yevul Nachri does not have the sanctity of Shemitah. The Minhag of Bnei Brak is to be Machmer. Now, what is happening in this Shemitah cycle, and this is again, this shows you the permeation of politics and religion, which is very strong in Israel, is, without rehashing too much Lashon Hara, I don't want to go over this, but as you may know, there is presently in the Torah world, well, maybe you don't know, and if you don't know, it's not important, but there's a big machlokas between Rav Shmuel Orbach and Rav Chaim Kanevsky. Now, what this machlokas is about is a bit of a mystery, even to people who are supposedly in the know, but Rav Shmuel Orbach represents, basically it involves what type of hisnagdut we should have towards the drafting yeshiva people. Should we just protest, or should we lie down in the street and get run over? So Rav Chaim Kanevsky says, you know, you protest, but if people have to go, they go. Rav Shmuel Orbach says, Yehari Val Yavor, you know, jump into the fire before you go. Okay, be it as it may, there's a very big machlokas. Now, this machlokas has nothing to do with Shemitah, obviously, nothing to do with Shemitah at all. But what you're finding is that as people are gravitating to Rav Chaim Kanevsky and Rav Aryeh Leib Steinman, they are incorporating Bnei Brak halachas into Yerushalayim, and that is why this Shemitah in particular, you will be hearing, more and more people will not rely even on the Eidah Haredes to buy Yevul Nachri, based on the fact that it has the sanctity of Shemitah. But that, I just want to tell you, that is not the Minhag Yerushalayim, and the Minhag Yerushalayim for hundreds and hundreds of years is to follow the Psak of the Beis Yosef, and again, the Eidah Haredes follows the Psak of the Beis Yosef. Okay. Okay, now again, be sure you understand, this is not referring to selling the land to non-Jews, this is referring to de facto land that is owned by non-Jews. What is the status of the produce? Okay. Let's now go forward to the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. So now we have the wave of Aliyah, and we have Jewish farmers. We have Petach Tikva that was founded, I don't know of all my dates, in the 1880s, and we have agricultural settlements. Once again, Shemitah becomes a live, important, real option because you have Jewish farmers. Now it might be that Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir were not overly, who were young people who came in those years. Perhaps we're not asking Shemitah questions, but there were indeed many, many Jews that were. And then you have to understand the following. Rav Kook came to Eretz Yisrael in the 1890s. He did not come as Rav Harashi. Remember, Rav Kook was a Rav in Lita, in Lithuania. And Rav Kook had a great, great yearning, a poetic yearning, a mystical yearning, which he had all of his life. In fact, it's interesting, on Rav Kook's Matseva and Harazesim, and they could have written so much, what a gain and a tzaddik he was, they only did three things, and I assume he instructed what should be written on his Matseva. It has three dates. The date he came to Eretz Yisrael, the date he came to Yerushalayim, and the date he was Olel HaShamayim, the date he was Nifter. Olel HaYaretz, date, Olel Yerushalayim. As far as Rav Kook was concerned, those were the three dates that were important in his life. So his first shteller in Eretz Yisrael was very small. He was the Rav of Yafo. Yafo, small, of course there was no Tel Aviv then, so Yafo was the only city there, but it was a fishing town, it was not a big town. He was the Rav of Yafo. And then he became the Rav of Yerushalayim. And then, under the British mandate, he was appointed to be the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, and of course many Haredim did not accept him in that role, and the like. But as both the Rav of Yerushalayim and as the Rav of Rav HaRashi of, there was no state of Israel, but the Rav HaRashi of Palestine or Eretz Yisrael, and the like, Rav Kook was very, very concerned with the possibilities of mass starvation. And this was not a joke. You know, we don't remember this. In some ways, the history of Jewish suffering in the 20th century is so massive that, as the Gemara says, Tzarot Achronot Mishakchot Et HaRishonot, which means the later Tzaros of the Holocaust, you know, 6 million Jews dying in the Holocaust, so we forgot all of the things that people went through even before the Holocaust. And particularly in Eretz Yisrael, around the beginning of the 20th century, around World War I, there was massive, massive, massive starvation. People were dying in the streets. Children were going for days without anything to eat. It was very, very common that one slice of bread would be shared among 10 children, and that would be their food for the day. So we are talking about people dying in the streets. That is how bad the starvation was. There's also malaria there. That's correct. In fact, to go into a hospital in those days was almost your death sentence, because hospitals were breeding grounds for disease. And of course, this is why, a little earlier than Rav Kook, this is why Moshe Montefiore, the great philanthropist, wanted to get the Jews out of the, because in the 1870s, all the Jews were concentrated in the Jewish quarter of the Old City, and they were crowded, the sanitary conditions were abhorrent, the water was polluted. He wanted to get them into more air, more space. Perhaps that could be a hygienic protection, and that's why he built all of these settlements, Nachalat Shiva, right, and all, and everything. Basically, every neighborhood in Yerushalayim that has the word Moshe in it was funded by Moses Montefiore. So now comes along Shemitah. So even under the productive years, starvation is rampant. Come Shemitah, Jewish people can't farm. What's going to be? And the whole, and in those days, the economy was not really developed enough that there was an extensive import industry of food and the like. So Rav Kook, reaching back to the Beis Yosef, developed the following idea. If we follow Rav Yosef Karo, which is indeed the Minhag Yerushalayim, and we say that because Shemitah is Midrabanan, the laws of Shemitah do not apply to land that is owned by non-Jews. And that's a given, and that was accepted. That wasn't even the controversy, except in Bnei Brak, which wasn't even invented yet. So why can't we do something such as, let us sell all of the farmable land to a cooperative non-Jew. So technically the non-Jew is the owner of that land. And once the non-Jew is the owner of that land, we can farm it, we can cultivate it, and we can produce food for an otherwise starving population, not subject to the laws of Shemitah. This was called the Heter Mashira, and it is miyusad on the Psak of the Beis Yosef, that says there is no laws of Shemitah to land that is owned by non-Jews. Now, one of the big controversies, and Rav Kook wrote a whole sefer justifying this, by the way. Rav Kook wrote a sefer, very fine sefer, that is still available, called Shabbat Haaretz. Actually, Shabbat Haaretz is actually a commentary on the Rambam Hilchos Shemitah. It's a halacha by halacha commentary. But the sefer begins with a 150-page introduction. So, but the introduction is the most important part of the sefer. The introduction is Rav Kook's defense of the Heter Mechira, and it is based on Shemitah being Midrabanan. In fact, he doesn't use Rav Yosef Karo's second drasha. And if it's Drabanan, the ownership of a guy could take away the mitzvot, teluyot, biaretz. And Rav Kook, justified this. And this became a great, great controversy. There were some gedolim in Europe, Rav Yitzchak Ochanan, great, the Posek Ador, who did agree with Rav Kook. Other gedolim, the Beis Halevi, the Nitziv, the Recholik and Rav Kook. And this goes on to this very, very day. Now, let me just explain a few different nakudas. When we analyze the notion of Heter Mechira, which still goes on today, the Rabbanut still does this today, right, you will see on certain packages, you'll say kosher al yedei heter mechira. Now, let me just mention that one preliminary question, which is still a very, very important question, is that even Rav Kook agreed to the Heter Mechira. Actually, he created the Heter Mechira because the alternative to Heter Mechira in those days would have been mass starvation. And obviously, when you're facing a near Pikuach Nefesh situation, then it makes sense that you'll look for every leniency that Halacha allows you to look for. The question that people ask is, good question, if Rav Kook himself would have been alive today, when we have the ability to import food, and it's not that difficult, I mean, listen, you can go into, you know, any supermarket and buy Cheerios or whatever, all sorts of American food. So why should we utilize the Heter Mechira when we no longer face the idea of starvation and the like? So it is a good question. It's hard for us to answer. It's hard for us to know what Rav Kook would say. It is important to know that historically, the situation that generated the Heter Mechira is not the same situation that we have today. Now the Ramanut says that they offer an alternative defense. The alternative defense is, well, okay, but here we have a situation where if we wouldn't have a Heter Mechira, so many farmers would just violate Shemitah anyway. They would work and cultivate. So the Heter Mechira is a vehicle where, at least according to some opinions, they're not committing a sin. So isn't it better to do something that will be matzil people from an aver? Now, well, that's an argument, but that's a different argument than Rav Kook made. In other words, that was not Rav Kook's argument. Rav Kook's argument was not, oh, let's do Heter Mechira so that non-religious farmers will not transgress halacha. Rav Kook's argument was, let's do Heter Mechira so people won't drop dead on the street. That's not the situation. Okay. I'm going to leave that aside because this is like people, you know, people still argue over this for over 100 years and they're going to continue to argue over this and the like. The short answer is, I don't know what Rav Kook would say, but nevertheless, the Heter Mechira is based on Rav Kook. Now, in Lamdas, there are three different issues about the Heter Mechira. Issue number one, does a sale to a guy help you? I mean, does it work at all? Now, if you follow the Mabit, which is the Pesach of Bnei Brak, then the Heter Mechira accomplishes nothing at all, because according to the Mabit, even land that is owned by non-Jews is subject to Shemitah laws, and the Isser of Shemitah still applies. So according to Mabit, which is the Pesach of Bnei Brak, Heter Mechira, there's no such thing as a Heter Mechira. There's no Heter in the Mechira. Even if you sell it, you're in the same boat. Okay, so obviously, and Rav Kook, of course, recognized this, that Heter Mechira can only make sense if you're working within the framework of Rav Yosef Karo. That's fine. Okay. But now, we have a secondary issue of great, great importance. And that is, let's assume that we follow the Beis Yosef. That if the land belongs to non-Jews, there's no Shemitah restrictions. But are you allowed to sell land to a non-Jew? Meaning, even if the sale works vis-a-vis Shemitah, are you allowed to effect it? What's the problem? In the list of the 613 commandments, there is actually a commandment that is stated in Parshas V'yeschanan called Lo Sechanem. It's referring to the non-Jewish nations that live in the land of Israel. And it says, do not show them favor or grace. But the Gemara in Avodah Zarah vocalizes the words a little differently. Instead of chen or chanina, it interprets it chaniya, lo sechanem, do not give a non-Jew an encampment in the land of Israel. And what that means halachically, and this is absolutely halacha, you are not allowed to sell land to a non-Jew in the land of Israel. That is an Isser D'oraisa. Can you rent to a non-Jew? You can, although I would not encourage having an Arab tenant. Sechirut is permitted. But Mechira is prohibited. So the Chazon Ish argued on the Heter Mechira. First of all, the Chazon Ish paskin like the Mabit, but he says, even if you say that non-Jewish property is not subject to the laws of Shemitah, you're not allowed to sell land to non-Jews. So, in order to avoid violating Shemitah Midrabanan, you're over in Isser D'oraisa. So the Chazon Ish's very, very strong argument was, it is forbidden min haTorah to sell land to non-Jews. Now, this itself would need a share by itself, because there are many, many opinions on this. Some say the prohibition only applies to idol worshippers or pagans, which may include Christians. It may not apply to Muslims that are monotheistic. That's one view. But the truth of the matter is, Rav Kook himself was well, Rav Kook knew his Chumash. Rav Kook was well aware of Lo Sechaneim, and he addressed it in the Shabbat Aretz. And Rav Kook gave different arguments in which he felt it was mutter. Number one, he said it would be mutter because it is only a temporary sale. The prohibition is to sell it permanently. Here the sale is structured that the guy will sell it back. Right, that's built into the conditions. Number two, Rav Kook was somech as a sniff, as a subsidiary argument on the monotheistic argument. And number three, Rav Kook argued the prohibition of selling land to non-Jews is only when the beneficiary is the non-Jew. Here, we're selling the land so that Jewish people will be able to cultivate it and benefit. And when the sale is for the benefit of the Jew, that is not within the scope of the prohibition. So Rav Kook was aware of this problem. Rav Kook still said it was mutter, but the Chazon Ish, who was a gadol in his own right, was machriya iser. Now, the Chazon Ish then said another twist, a very fascinating twist. How is the land practically sold to a non-Jew? Well, the way it works is, farmers sign up who want to participate, sign up on a registry, they make the Rabbanut their shaliach, and the Rabbanut then sells, the chief rabbi then sells the land to a cooperative non-Jew. Some guy, some Arab owns all of this land. Now, the Chazon Ish made the following argument. This is a brilliant argument. I hope you can follow this. The Chazon Ish said, we have a rule in the laws of shalichut, when you make somebody a shaliach, that if I make a shaliach to do an aveira, let's say I make a shaliach and I tell a shaliach, go ahead and cook some food for me on Shabbos. Now normally, when a shaliach does something for me, it's as if I did it. So if I make you a shaliach to desecrate the Shabbos, and you desecrate Shabbos, who has the aveira? Me or the shaliach? So the Talmud says, we have a principle called ein shaliach v'dvar aveira. You cannot be a messenger, commit a sin, meaning the shaliach is chayev, and not the mishaliach. So here the Chazon Ish says the following. If you're not allowed to sell your land to a guy, when you make the Rabbanut a shaliach to sell your land, it's not a valid shlichus, because they can't be a shaliach to do a sin. Therefore, the Chazon Ish says, not only is the land prohibited to be sold, the sale is not valid. So it still belongs to the Jew. It's an interesting argument. In other words, it still belongs to you, because ain't shaliach but varavayr. Okay. Alright. So, issue number one is, does a sale to a guy help? That's the machlokes, Rav Yosef Karo and the Mabit. Issue number two is, even if it helps, is it permitted? That's the Machlokas Rav Kook and the Chazon Ish. Now, there's a third question that people discuss, and that is the sale just a joke? Because here you have a Jewish farmer sells his land, and then he continues to cultivate the land, he continues to harvest the fruit, he continues to market the fruit. As far as the Chiloni is concerned, you know, it's totally his land, it's like just signing. So perhaps we should say, if there's no serious intent to sell the property, it's not really sold. Well, here already, we have the strong analogy of selling chametz, because on this shaila, you have a very similar type of problem. That is, for hundreds of years, Jews sell their chametz to a non-Jew. Now, the logic of the sale is, the Torah says, you as a Jew are not allowed to own chametz during Pesach, but if it belongs to a non-Jew, it's not my chametz. But you sell it, you keep it in your house, you lock it up in a closet. If the guy were to show up, which he has the right to do, you might kick him out. So once again, Rav Kook makes the argument that if we allow sale to a non-Jew, even for chametz, which is absolutely a Torah violation, then how much more so we should not be overly machmir on selling the land to a goy on Shemitah, which at worst is a rabbinic violation. Okay, so these are the issues of Hetzer Mechira. Let me point out once again that Heter Mechira is based, therefore, on a combination of three yesodot. There are three ideas in the Heter Mechira. Idea number one is the psak of the Beis Yosef, that once land belongs to non-Jews, at least for a mitzvah drabanan like Shemitah, it does not have the kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, therefore the land can be cultivated, and therefore the produce does not have the laws of Shemitah. Now, on that prong, the Minhag Yerushalayim agrees. Even the Badatz will certify Yevul Nachri as being mutter. Prong number two, selling the land to the non-Jew is not a violation of the law of Lo Sechanem, either because it's temporary or because it's to monotheists. I was going to say ethical monotheists, but I don't know if I want to, I don't want to use the term ethical in this context, but at least monotheists. Or because it's for the purpose of enhancing Jewish settlement. And foundation number three is, even if the Chiloni, or whoever's participating, continues to work the land, it is analogous to my keeping chametz in my house, in which it is still a valid sale. These are the three foundations upon which the Heter Mechira is based. And I would add a fourth foundation, that in spite of Rav Kook talking a lot about the extremity of the conditions in the land of Israel, the Rabbanut has felt over the years that even without the extremity of those conditions, we can rely on these three prongs. Meaning even when it's not a mass starvation scenario, we can rely on these prongs. Okay? So this is the package, so to speak, the package of concepts which underlie the Heter Mechira. Now, as everybody knows, the so-called Mahadrin Hashkachot and the yeshiva world generally does not rely on the Heter Mechira. Now, let me ask you, what does that mean? I mentioned four principles. Which of the principles do they not rely upon? Meaning to say, now people just say, I don't hold of Heter Mechira. What don't you hold of in Heter Mechira? There are four ideas in Heter Mechira. Which one don't you hold of? Most people say, I just don't hold of it. Whatever, okay. So the answer is this. It depends. If you are a Chazonish person, if you are a B'nai Brak person, you don't hold of the Heter Mechira because you simply paskin like the Mabit. So like the Mabit, Heter Mechira makes no sense whatsoever, simply because land owned by a Goy is the same as land owned by a Jew, so you've accomplished nothing. All of the Shemitah rules apply. Okay. But if you ask a Yerushalmi, if you ask the Eid HaRedis, why don't you hold the Heter Mechira? They're not going to say because they follow the Mabit. In fact, they follow the Beis Yosef. In fact, the Badatz absolutely will certify Yevul Nachri as not having the laws of Shemitah, but they will disagree either because they say there's a violation of Lo Sechanem, selling land. Well, besides that, they don't like the Rabbanut, which is more of a gut reaction, which is very powerful. There are abhorrence of the Rabbanut, but that's a separate issue. But either they will say that there's an issue of selling the land to the guy, or they will say it's a joke because the farmer does not really intend to sell the land, and if you ask them why is it different than chametz, they really don't have a good answer, but that's the idea. Huh?
Does everybody agree on selling the chametz?
Not everybody does. By the way, that's a new chumrah. You'll notice creeping in. In fact, a very, very important Chashuv Rebbe in Or Sameach was talking to me. He says he was very concerned because he feels that in his community in Mattersdorf, people are no longer buying any chametz that was sold to a guy. They're only buying new flour that was ground. And you know, she feels like a guy. She's going in and she's buying, you know, like she always did. She relied on Mechira's chametz. So actually, that's spreading. That's a new thing that people are not relying on Mechira's chametz. Perhaps that's also a B'nai Brak influence. I'm not sure. But okay. Be it as it may. Now, so that is why, for these various reasons, what are called Mahadrin Hashkachot do not rely on Heter Mechira, but they will rely in Yerushalayim on Yevul Nachri. Okay. So now, let's go to a very, very important question. If you maintain that the Heter Mechira is forbidden because of Lo Sechanein, but you follow the Beis Yosef, once the Mechira occurs, it's still going to be a valid Mechira. So here's my question. How does this affect me as a consumer? It affects me as a farmer, because basically I'm being told I'm not allowed to sell my land to a guy. Good, so I'm not allowed to do that. But let's say I did it. Right? Heter Mechira. I did it. I followed the Rabbanut. You are now a consumer. You're not a farmer. You didn't sell your land to a guy. You didn't do anything wrong. So the question becomes, why can't you buy? Let's take two. Why can't you buy? In other words, how does all of this debate translate into why I can't buy Heter Mechira produce? I'm not that. But I'm not telling you can't buy. I'm saying, but if you maintain that you don't follow Heter Mechira, then you will not buy Heter Mechira produce. I want to know why. In other words, why does the farmer's sin translate into any type of prohibition on me to eat the food? What would stop an ultra-Haredi person from buying Heter Mechira produce? The answer is, surprisingly, it's a relatively small principle that stops him. Heter Mechira produce, and again, I am not disparaging the Rabbanut. I mean, the Rabbanut maintains that it's mutter, and if you follow that, that's 100% fine. But I'm speaking on the other side. Let's assume you maintain that the Heter Mechira is not proper. But my question still is, why can't I eat it if that's what I subscribe to? So here is the part of the problem. There is a principle in the laws of Shemitah that says that if produce was created in violation of the laws of Shemitah, you are not allowed to financially support the wrongdoer by buying it. Meaning, it's not intrinsically treif, but by buying it even on a retail basis, you are in effect financially supporting activity that was considered to be prohibited. So, like the Mabit, it was prohibited to farm the land, and like the Chazon Ish, it was prohibited to sell the land. So to buy Heter Mechira produce is not, it's not treif. In fact, once you bought it, you would be allowed to eat it, but it is prohibited, like that position, to buy it, because this is a category that is called Mechazek Ovrei Aveira. You are giving strength and encouragement to those who were involved in a transgression. What transgression? Either the transgression of farming their land if the sale was not valid, because it was a joke, or farming their land like the Mabit, which is only B'nai Brak Psak, or violating Lo Sechanein by selling the land to a non-Jew. You are Mechazek Ovrei Aveira. Now, how are you Mechazek Ovrei Aveira? By financially supporting an enterprise that was not allowed to be done. So, here we have a very interesting distinction. I'm not allowed, now again, please understand, I don't want to give the wrong impression. When I keep on saying I'm not allowed, I am referring to people who maintain that the Heter Mechira is usher. I am not telling you it is usher, but if I maintain the Heter Mechira is usher, I'm not allowed to buy because of the principle of Mechazek Ovrei Aveira. Okay. So now let's change the scenario. Let's say instead of buying Heter Mechira produce, I'm invited, let's say I'm on a camping trip or I'm in a car and my seatmate offers me some Heter Mechira produce. Can I eat it? Let's say I'm a guest in their home. Can I eat it? So here we have a fascinating point. Since I did not buy it, since I did not financially support the enterprise, then technically I am not Mechazek Ovrei Aveira. So if I'm not Mechazek Ovrei Aveira, then even if my own halachic position is that Heter Mechira is improper, I would be allowed under those circumstances. Very important. This is a psak of Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and it makes perfect sense once you understand the issue. I am allowed to consume Heter Mechira produce under circumstances where I did not encourage by financial support. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, since there is a tzad that the sale was not effective, you have to treat it as if it was Shemitah produce, and therefore you can eat it, but you have to eat it with the laws of Shemitah. In other words, that's the only Zahirut that you'd have to have. You see, it's important to understand this, because Shemitah is very confusing, because people will say a lot of things, oh, it's usher, it's usher, it's usher. It is not, Hetcha Mechira produce is not usher, like any opinion. It may be usher to sell your land to the guy, and it may be usher to cultivate your land if it's been sold to the guy. But that doesn't translate into being usher to eat it. The only usher is to buy it because of Mechazek Ovrei Avera, and to eat it when you didn't buy it. The worst would be, the worst case scenario is, if the sale is not valid because of Lo Sechanem, you'd have to eat it with Kedusha Shvias. If the sale is valid, then you wouldn't even have to do that, but Misafek at least. You should eat Kedusha Shvias. Okay? So this is, so people should not panic. And again, I want to emphasize that, I am not at all disparaging Hetcha Mechira. If you're asking me, should you follow it? Well, if you're asking me personally, I would say no. But that's simply because I believe that the Rav Kook's Hachra'ot were very much limited to, a mass starvation condition. On the other hand, anyone that does follow it has very, very eminent authority, to be Somichan, and, including the Rav Adi Yosef, in fact, it's very unfortunate. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach actually wrote the same thing, that although he did not rely on Hetcha Mechira, but he felt that those who did had a very good basis, and that was literally censored from his sefer. It was taken out of his sefer. The whole story about, because it was not in the spirit of the Haredi world culture at the time. So if you compare two editions of his form, the first edition and the later editions, which were printed after he died, you'll see that that was not there. So if anyone follows that Mechira, Chas V'Shalom, I am not saying anything negative about it. But what I do want to inform you, again, is to emphasize, even if you maintain a strict position, you are allowed to eat Hetcha Mechira produce under circumstances where you did not financially support it, as long as you eat it with the laws of Shemitah. Yeah.
Is there a distinction eating in a friend's home, but you're not providing any financial benefit?
Yes.
And eating in a restaurant?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's a good point. Absolutely. Eating in a restaurant would be the same as buying in a store. So if you maintain the Hetcha Mechira is not a permissible procedure, you would not be allowed to eat in a restaurant, at least if you're paying. Maybe if somebody else is paying, it's not clear. But you would not be allowed to eat in a restaurant that follows Hetcha Mechira. That's 100% the case. It's only eating in a friend's home where that would be permitted. Okay, have a good week, everybody. That's what Davin Marif.